Okay, so Jewish approaches to mythical creatures or werewolf bar mitzvah. Is that a reference that anyone appreciates? Everyone should go home at some point, and at some point on the show 30 Rock, which I never watched, there's... I don't know if they actually wrote the whole song, but there's a song on the show at some point called Werewolf Bar Mitzvah. It's, like, surprisingly catchy. It's, like, really fun to listen to. So, you know, I cannot recommend the show. I don't know anything about it, but it's a cute song, perfectly kosher, funny premise. So this is clearly a generational thing, which, that's all right. So we're not actually going to talk about werewolves being bar mitzvahed, which, as far as I know, if they exist, they probably can be bar mitzvahed, in as much as they're people, I guess, I assume. But more about the global question that kind of lies in the background, which is how to think about references to things like werewolves or other seemingly supernatural, beyond the realm of human experience kinds of creatures that we find in Torah sources, in rabbinic sources, in like traditional Judaism. So I picked one several weeks ago, we talked about the Leviathan and like one particular angle, pardon me, on this question, whether the Leviathan is meant to represent some real creature, like a crocodile, or is meant to be a little bit more mythic, and we had different theories about that. That was a specific example. But what we're going to do today is look at one more example of that phenomenon, in this case, werewolves, and then try to abstract the question, right? So in this case, to think about, in general, systematically, whenever you see these kinds of ideas, how you're supposed to relate to them. And we'll be presenting a number of approaches. I want to, in particular, recommend a book as well that does a lot of this kind of work, which is a book called Sacred Monsters. It's a book by Rabbi Natan Slifkin, a.k.a. Zoo Rabbi. Right, so he's... Yeah, so he's... Sorry? He was someone who was educated in like the classic yeshiva world. At some point, he developed an interest in zoology, the animal kingdom, and did a little bit of research and wrote a couple of books in that area, and has since become a bit more of a voice for like a more scientific, he calls it rationalist kind of approach to Judaism that he really tries to champion. But some of his books are very explicitly, animal-related. He runs now a museum in Israel called the Biblical Museum of Natural History, where he also, does a lot of research into the animals of the biblical world, the animals of ancient Israel. A lot of really fantastic resources. And so in this book, Sacred Monsters, he goes through, tons of these mythical kinds of creatures and discusses where they're attested to in traditional Jewish sources, how those sources have been understood by Jewish authorities in the past, and bring some, zoology and biology to the picture to kind of flesh things out. So it was a great book. If you're interested in this kind of thing, what's the deal with werewolves or vampires or basilisks or any other kind of, griffins, whatever kind of creature you want to think about Jewish sources. Sacred Monsters. A lot of it happens to be available on Google Books. So sometimes when you like Google the name of a book, you could see a link to it on Google and then like actually preview a good chunk of the book. So I have been able to do that, which is also a very helpful resource. I'm glad it is publicly available. Well, so some of his books are Natan Slifkin, and then later on he had a religious transformation. He became Natan Slifkin. So I don't know what happened there, but you'll see some of his old books are Natan as opposed to Natan. Both are fine.
During COVID, I'm sure. That was a program. Our show had this touring that unbelievable museum. We decided to go.
Oh, I'm sure it's wonderful. I've never had the chance to visit, but definitely something, a person to be aware of and a project to be aware of. Every time you see, even when you're just learning Chumash regularly and you see a reference to a Nesher, so people will tell you it's eagles, and Slifkin will do the research and I'll tell you, no, the Nesher is actually the griffin vulture and not an eagle. So, like, it's a lot of, good research on, both the natural and the supernatural realm of, animal life in Tanakh. Really cool stuff, very interesting. If you like this kind of stuff, it's a great book. But we're not going to focus on the book right now, though we'll see some sources that are from the book as I was able to look at it. But we'll look at specifically some of the material he presents by werewolves, and one source that he doesn't present, but others have presented kind of following his path here. So there are a couple of sources in medieval Ashkenaz, so medieval France, medieval Germany, that seem to take it as a given that werewolves exist. So it's not like they're going out of their way to say, let me tell you about these funny creatures called werewolves. They're making some other point, and by the by, kind of making a passing comment about werewolves. And that's actually quite important, because that indicates that it wasn't something that needed to be justified. It's not like I'm going to talk about werewolves and explain to you why I know they exist. We all agree, everyone in this room, everyone reading this text knows there are things called werewolves. Let me just make a point about those creatures. So, for example, we can look at our first source. This is from Sefer Chassidim. This is a very interesting kind of work in medieval Germany. I'm not going to get into the details right now, but in almost a passing comment, he's talking about the Nachash, the snake that existed in Gan Eden. And he says, HaNachash haya mahalech al shtayim, it used to walk on two legs. Uktzat dmut adam alav, and it had a sort of human-like shape. It's a little bit vague about what that means, but the snake is not like a snake that we can imagine. It's something with legs. It seems to stand upright. Tida, and you should know about, like the snake, there are other creatures that have the same characteristic. Tida, she'odem she'yodem lahapich adam lezev. You should know that those who can turn a person into a wolf, o lechatul, or to a cat, o lechamor, or to a donkey, galgal ha'ayin lo yitapech. Right? So this seems like the fruit of fairy tales, right? You know, you can look at an animal in the eye and you can tell if it used to be a person. Right? If it's really a person at heart, so to speak. And just like that's true for all those other creatures, so too, v'chein ha'nachash nishtana lo nishtanu ha'inayim. The eyes of the serpent also were the same, you know, in its more serpentine and more human forms. So what he's saying about the snake in Gan Eden, it's a little bit beyond me. I'm not really sure what he means in that context. But again, what he takes as sort of a background is that this process of, oh, you used to be a person, now you're a wolf, that's like a known phenomenon. We all know that that's how it works, and I'm just applying that idea to our discussion of the snake. Right? Now, this is a little bit interesting because it seems a little bit less like a werewolf, a person who turns themselves into a wolf and back, but someone who is turned into these creatures. So it's more like witchcraft, but it's in the family of the people transforming into animal space. That's a better example of this. The more exciting example of this is the biblical model. Yeah, quickly?
What does it mean by his eyeball does not change? Does that mean that for an animal that used to be a human, you can tell by looking? Does that mean that the eyeball, he's not blinking or something?
I assume that, you know, think of the eye of a cat, right?
Yeah.
So cat eyes and human eyes don't look the same. Right. So even if a person was turned into a cat and their body changed,
their eyes
wouldn't change. So you'd be able to look at their eyes and, oh, those are distinctively human eyes. So obviously this is a, what do they call it in the Harry Potter series? An animagus, thank you. Right? So maybe something along those lines. There are also obviously, you know, werewolves in that series. Spoiler alert for one of the books. I won't tell you which one because you haven't read it yet. You definitely should. But that seems to be the idea here. And I think you have the sense in that, well, actually, I don't remember, right? And can you tell by looking at, what's his name? Pettigrew when he's a rat. What's he called when he's a rat? I'm relying on the Potterheads in the room. Scavenge. I don't know. Thank you. Could you tell by looking at Scavenge with a person? Probably not. That's how he manages to, you know, get away with it for so many books. So maybe the Harry Potter world doesn't quite know this midrashic sort of tradition. There's a better example. This is like the mind-bending example, right? It's in Tanakh, right? So some of the Rishonim picked up on this phrase in the blessings that Yaakov gives to his sons. He describes Binyamin. How does he describe Binyamin? Binyamin ze'ev yitraf. Binyamin is a ravaging wolf. Ba'boker yochal ad, in the morning he eats. Ve'la'erav yechalek shalal, in the evening he divides his plunder. So I think most of us would see this as, you know, nice metaphorical language. You know, Binyamin is very strong, Binyamin is mighty, Binyamin is going to be able to succeed in war. But some of the Rishonim took it more literally, in ways that we can anticipate at this point. Yeah.
The king of Amalek
who
turned himself into a sheep.
Right. So if you want to, you know, we could pick other examples of this. This idea of people turning into animals has a broad, like, midrashic history. So that's another example of it, right? Where Agag, right, in the story by Shaul, you know, some of the Midrash Masumi transformed himself, so that's why he wasn't killed and then was able to get away and, you know, keep the Amaleki dynasty alive. So yeah, that's another good example. And there are others. This is very much like a surface level treatment of the issue, right? We could look at all sorts of, you know, exceptional cases. But just digging into to Binyamin a little bit, so we're going to make a few claims about Binyamin that are actually going to explain parts of his life story, which we, again, might have taken in more naturalistic kind of ways or metaphorical kind of ways. And some of these commentaries, like Rabbeinu Ephraim, who's one of the Tosafists, right? So in this sort of generation following Rashi and Ashkenaz in France and Germany, taking it in this way. So, and he says this throughout his commentary on Bereishis. So this is not like a one-time comment. This is really a thesis that he has, that these things exist and that Binyamin was one of them. So in the very beginning of the Torah, we're told that we're all created in the image of God, the Tzelem Elohim. And so the Rabbeinu Ephraim says, okay, well, there are different rules of letter associations, right? If any of us have heard of Atbash, right? So the Atbash works is you could understand a word by sort of inverting its letter along like the middle axis of the alphabet. So Aleph is Tav, Bet is Shin. You know, as you convert towards the middle of the alphabet, the letters get closer together. There's another version of this called Albam, which is, you know, you start from the first of the first half of the alphabet to the first of the second half of the alphabet. Aleph Lamed, Bet Mem, Gimel Nun, etc., etc. So Rabbeinu Ephraim says, well, take the word Tzelem. In the Albam system of, you know, literary linguistic analysis, Tzelem corresponds to Ze'ev, wolf. Lekach, therefore, Otam b'nei Adam shebishtanim la'ze'ev, therefore those people who become wolves, Nivru mishishi mebereishit, they were created that way, so to speak, from the 6 days of creation. Right, so all the animals were created, human beings were created, and among the creatures of that day were apparently werewolves. Now, I don't know if they're closer to the human side, closer to the animal side. It seems like they're closer to the human side of the picture, if they're made in Tzelem Elohim, the image of God. And then it tells you something interesting about werewolves. It says, "V'ein chozrim l'kadmutan ad she'ochlim dam adam o isha," where werewolves don't go back to being human until they consume some blood. Okay, I don't know where this idea comes from, but it's not like he's driving from the psukim. That's important. It's not like he's reading Chumash very closely and inferring the existence of werewolves. Again, he's assuming the existence of werewolves and applying it to explain details in the text. He'll do the same thing by Binyamin. So when he says, in source number 4, Davar Acher, so he's making some comment in a different context, but Davar Acher, Ki Binyamin haya ze'ev yitroth. Binyamin was a ravaging wolf, v'toret b'nei adam le'itim, and would occasionally maul people and attack people. And there are, when the time came, so I don't know what time that is, maybe it's the full moon, he doesn't say. When the time came, he would turn into a wolf. Right? So in the psukim here, the brothers are telling Yosef, Binyamin cannot come down, he won't survive. So we thought, oh, the idea here is that, you know, Yaakov won't survive his son leaving him, or, you know, maybe Binyamin is a young kid, the journey won't be so good for him. No. Binyamin is sick, he's a werewolf. When he's at home with his father, he's with the doctor. And he would prevent him from being turned into a werewolf. Apparently it's a kind of like medical condition that you could solve. That's why he says he will leave his father and he will die. Not Yaakov, but Binyamin. Kalomar, when he leaves his father, he will turn into a wolf. With those who he's traveling with. And he'll be a wolf. And someone will see a wolf and say, well, I better kill that. It's a wolf, and Binyamin's going to be killed. Right? So he's explaining a pasuk. Why does it say that Binyamin will die when he leaves his father? And again, on this background assumption, we all know, of course, that he's one of these wolf people. And he's going to further double down on this thesis again. And this is a much longer paragraph. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But he explains a couple of other details. So he explains, for example, what's one of the interesting examples? Let me just, you can look at the whole passage. I'm sorry, yes?
It's just like, I'm not ready for before. It's just like,
yeah, he's like a normal Rishon. He has a normal commentary on Chumash. He's one of the, you know, family of Tosafists. And this is just a thing he says. Right? again, he doesn't, there's no sense that you get in reading this that he knows that he's being controversial, that he's being wacky, right? He doesn't think of himself in this, it seems, like a fringe person. He's just giving you a thesis to explain Chumash.
I'm just going
to
ask you, is it the same Binyamin that we all know?
This is the Binyamin who is the tribe. So, so I'll pick like the most, you know, exciting example of this paragraph, but there are a few others. So in the middle of, and I'll read it in English just for ease of interpretation, I suppose. In the middle, very middle of the English, four words on the beginning of the line, and likewise, Benjamin ate his mother, who died on his accord. I mean, we know that Rachel died when Binyamin was born. Well, it wasn't because of a difficult childbirth.
Wait, what?
It was because he was a werewolf. And giving birth to a werewolf is probably not very safe.
Probably.
Did I hear that correctly?
Does not say that in Chumash. I will tell you that. But this is, again, this is just another example of this assumption that is driving this commentary. Right? He's assuming this information. He's interpreting the psukim on that basis. And there are a few other things about this, like a person who's a werewolf, even in their human form, they still have a tail. And so too, in the portion of Binyamin in Eretz Yisrael, in the last line in the English, you could see this. There's going to be a little bit of land, you know, sort of sticking out of Binyamin's portion, kind of like a tail, and that's where the Beit HaMikdash is going to be. Right, so the approach here. And again, this is a, you know, he doesn't talk about this every page. Like, he has a commentary that is mostly, you know, a normal, interesting commentary on Chumash, like in the way that any other Rishon has a commentary on Chumash. And like, by the by, he'll throw out these little comments. Okay, so what do we do with this, right? Like, this is, you know, I think we were like laughing a little bit. There's definitely something like a little unusual or uncomfortable about seeing sources like this. So we'll try to figure out an approach that, or several approaches that might help us like pave a way in dealing with this kind of idea.
So when she said, the son of my affliction, that this interpretation is the affliction of like him eating her.
Again, so the idea, you know, eating, I assume is
whatever way.
Right, exactly. So yes, like the psukim say that Rachel died after giving birth to Binyamin. Right, but there's like a simple reading, which is a normal, difficult childbirth, and then there's this reading, which is one level beyond that, or maybe two levels beyond that.
Only two?
I don't know how many levels you want, okay? You want four levels, you get out four levels. The final example of this phenomenon, and again, I just want to demonstrate that this is not a one-off fringe idea. So I've shown you two sources that assume it. I've shown you that one of those sources takes it as a thesis that he's willing to apply several times in his commentary. I'll give you a third source, also in the medieval Ashkenazic world, and it's a pretty big name. It's the name of Rashi. So Rashi in this pasuk in Iyov, there's this phrase, the beast of the field will be at peace with you. So you have to imagine like what kinds of beasts of the field we're talking about. So Rashi says that's called a grusa. And we don't know what that is because Rashi will oftentimes interpret phrases in Hebrew into his vernacular, which of course was medieval French, which is not helpful to the modern reader. But when you look at the dictionaries of ancient French, you find that term, grusa, however you pronounce it, is a adam ze'ev, a man-wolf, a werewolf. And so there's reason to think that at least three Rishonim, and there are probably others, assumed as a fact of nature that werewolves were real, and used that to interpret different parts of Chumash, or offer different interpretations of, the snake by Gan Eden, etc. Okay, so I don't know if anyone here is now persuaded, right? Anyone here who did not originally believe in werewolves, I shouldn't presume what anyone believes. But anyone who didn't believe in werewolves is now going to turn around and say, well, because an authoritative traditional Jewish source says that werewolves exist, my mind has been changed. I don't know if anyone feels that way. Shouldn't presume, but I would guess not. But these are, you know, we don't want to sort of willy-nilly cast aside authoritative Jewish sources. Like, you know, the increasing level here, right, we get to Rashi at the end of the day. You don't want to be in a position where you're throwing Rashi out the window. Like, that's a somewhat of a black mark on a Jewish commitment if you're willing to toss Rashi at a moment's notice. So we have to figure out an approach or again, like I said, multiple approaches to navigate this kind of evidence. And we could do this again with other things, right? If you want to talk about vampires, we could do vampires. Maybe Aesop was a vampire. I don't know. Aesop does try to bite Yaakov's neck. That's an interesting thing that most people don't do to each other. I don't know. Right? So you could go creature by creature and figure it out for each, you know, different kind of animal or each different kind of creature. But the methodology, right, the approach for dealing with it is going to be similar, or at least you'll have the same tools in your toolkit to deal with it. And that's what we're going to do for the second half of the learning. So part one, I've established Jews thought werewolves existed. That's like a basic baseline. And we want to figure out how to deal with that. Like serious Jews, not, you know, hoi polloi, non-serious people who are not necessarily representative of the Masorah. Yes?
I think Aesop's more of a werewolf because he's covered in hair and it's red.
Yeah, but you ever see a red-headed werewolf?
Well, blood is red.
Touche. Okay, touche. I mean, in like popular media. I don't know if you ever see in...
I mean, yeah, I have.
Yeah?
In popular TV shows and stuff.
Can you give me an example? I'm just so curious. I've actually never occurred to me.
Diaries,
yeah?
The originals, legacies, the history shows with me. I wanted to see that book.
What?
Didn't you write it down?
Yeah.
We'll talk about it. It's very good. I can even send you guys a link to the one that's available on Google Books, again, which is part, you know, not everything, but a lot of it is available there. Okay. So we're going to talk about a few different approaches to tackling this kind of question. And the goal is not that there should be one approach that's always going to work. That might be true. Sometimes it might not be. But the goal is that we should try to expand our, you know, ways of thinking about these kinds of issues. We're going to do, I think, a catalog 5 approaches at the end of the day. Could be a little bit more, could be a little bit less. We'll figure out as many as we go. Okay, so first answer, option 1, is give up. That's like a cynical way of saying it. Or live with the question. You know what? It's okay to have questions sometimes. Rashi thought there were werewolves. I don't think there are werewolves. That's fine. Let's go daven mincha and have dinner. Like, it doesn't really, you know, keep me up at night. Right? So, Slifkin. And if you want, by the way, the name of the book, it's in source number 9 and also, again, in source 14 and source 22. So, you'll see the name of the book and the introductory chapter was, you know, foundational for most of what we're doing today. He really maps out these kinds of approaches very nicely. I'm really just a vehicle to access them. So one could simply confess ignorance. We should not expect, with our limited knowledge and experience, to be able to resolve all difficulties in the Talmud, or in Tanakh, or in the Rishonim, or in any other source. This author, myself, Slifkin, is still left with many questions and difficulties, not only concerning the topics in this volume, but also many others. And the most accurate, suitable response is to simply admit and accept that one does not have the solution. And he quotes a great, people will quote this idea a lot. I don't quote Yiddish aphorisms as often as I might like to, but I get to sometimes. Funakasha starpt man nicht. You don't die from a question. You can live with a question, and it's going to be fine, and you can still be a religiously connected person who's committed. And yeah, this is a difficulty you don't really understand. And then what he does, and I like this a lot, is he gives you a language for why you should want this, right? Because part of picking these answers is figuring out what answers are kind of religiously resonant with you. Like, what is something that, you could live with. You could sit with this answer. So he frames this idea in an address from Rav Matityahu Solomon. He actually passed away this year. It was a sort of significant rabbinic figure. And in one of his addresses at a Daf Yomi Siyum, he says as follows. Shas, the Talmud, is faith-based knowledge. When faced with the most difficult questions, we don't take the easy way out. We would rather wait for Eliyahu to come. Why settle for a makeshift answer if we will be handed the reliable solution at a later date? Teiku is the answer. Teiku when you get to, you know, sometimes the Gemara will have a question, you know, try to figure out what the law should be in such and such a case, and it will conclude, Teiku, we don't really know the answer. Right, we're going to leave the question because we're not sure. That's how Teiku is used in the Gemara. So Teiku is the answer. We don't know. We have good questions. None of our answers are good. We're going to sit with the question. From the graves of the giants of wisdom and purity, Abaye and Rava, emerges the truth that can never be repudiated by the midgets of our generation. So I think we could draw out from this formulation, and this is just one sort of representative formulation. Other people would make this claim as well. I think two ideas about why this is a religiously appealing approach and why we should want to live with the question. Because I can tell you to live with the question all you want, but I have to convince you that you should live with the question. So one value that he articulates is we don't take the easy way out. Sometimes the answers feel a little forced. They're not such great answers. You know, we could come up with something that kind of like ties us over, but it's not so satisfying, so we don't want to commit to a not so good answer. Better wait. Maybe we'll get a better answer later. So it's a sort of intellectual claim that let's not jump the gun, right? The question is better than the answer. Happens all the time. And the second value he articulates is the value of Yirida Hadorot. Anything that Rabbeinu Ephraim and Rashi could understand, I'm not on a level to understand. So if I don't understand what they understood, that's fine. But at no point can I say, like, I don't understand it, I need to figure out how they possibly could have believed these things, because he's Rashi, he's Rabbeinu Ephraim, he's Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, they're serious people, they're bigger Talmidei Chachamim, they're greater people than I am, and so I should trust them. If they say it, I assume it's makes sense and it's true. Ah, contradicts what we know about science. They must have figured it out. So that's the argument. It's a very deferential argument. It's one that has a lot of intellectual humility behind it, not wanting to stake firmer claims that we feel are justified. Someone give me a little bit of pushback. Like, what's the downside to a life of live with the question? Why would you not want to sort of stop here and like get up and walk out?
You don't have an answer.
You don't have an answer. So you actually want to understand a thing, and the more you understand of something, the better. So you try to understand it, right? You don't read a line of Chumash and say, I don't understand this pasuk. Well, I could live with the question. You're supposed to learn, and you're supposed to know things. So you'll learn, and as you learn, you try to think of questions and good answers to them. Excellent. What else might be a weakness of this approach? Especially if you like take it systematically, like always living in a let's live with the question kind of model.
Because in the Torah, you're supposed to ask questions.
This is very positive. We, you know, questioning is a way to search for knowledge. We don't want to kind of stop at the level of questions because you never get to the value of questions, which is to understand things, for sure. There's a third angle. There's a third angle, another weakness to why we don't want to live with questions. And this is something that I think the more you are a producer of Judaism as opposed to a consumer, this will be a little bit more resonant, meaning the more you feel like responsible for the system as a whole. You know, think of yourself as a teacher for a second. So if every time a student asked you a question, you said, okay, so you live with the question. So first of all, the student's going to stop asking questions because they know the answer. You live with the question. And what message does that communicate about Judaism?
We don't have answers.
We don't have answers, right? Like, there's a certain number of questions that you could live with. Okay, I could live with these questions, this questions, these more peripheral questions, even bigger central questions. But I can't live like my whole life in a state of confusion and lack of understanding. And in fact, when you stifle questions and you make it seem like questions are not valuable, that like puts that makes it seem like Judaism can't withstand the scrutiny. That if you tried to ask us questions, you wouldn't be able to come up with answers, and you'd eventually be led down this path where like everything is just taken on faith. Now taking some things on faith is valuable, but taking everything on faith might be too much. The Maharal in source number 10 tries to make this argument. I think it's a really powerful formulation. Lekach. The English is on page 5, the Hebrew is on page 4 on the bottom. Ein ra'ui leharchik shum devar hamenageret al da'ato la'avad hachakira v'hayidia. One should not distance things that seem to challenge your own preconceived notions, your own preconceived understandings. Rather, you know, you should love the inquiry and the knowledge that you're going to pursue. Ubefrat, specifically, otro shalo kivin lekanter. Especially if they're not trying to attack, right? So there are some students who ask questions like, gotcha questions. Rabbi, the Torah is so dumb because blah, blah, blah. That's the reason why, you know, a person might say that they think the Torah is dumb. So that's a gotcha kind of question. Those questions, maybe there's more room to say, like, that's not the tone that we talk about when we talk about Torah. But if you're not asking for and to antagonize, but rather Rakla Hagita Emunah Sherito, but just to express like the truth that you have, right, your own faith, your own belief, then even if those things are against the Torah, still you should accept the questions, because doing so will lead to further clarity in religion. And so number one, right, the idea is that by answering and asking questions, you'll get more clarity and closer to the truth. And second of all, he talks about this idea, and jumping to the second to last line, the first line on page 5 in the Hebrew. Lekach davar ze hepech ma shechushim ksat b'nei adam. Some people think the opposite of this. Ki chushim kasher in rashai ledaber al adat, hu chizuk hadat, v'tukef shalo. They think that what makes religion strong is when it's unquestionable. By definition, it's true. Don't question my authority. That proves that my religion has authority. Because you can't question it. The Maharal says what your face is saying. Everyone take a good look. The Maharal says, no, that's the weakness of religion. If it can't stand up to questioning, it shows that it's a frail thing that can't handle a fight, that can't handle a challenge. Ki helen divraham et nagid badat, hiding all the things that contradict your belief, ein ze rak bitul v'cholshat hadat. It's the weakness of religion. It's not the strength. So the Maharal says, don't be a live with the questions kind of person. Because Judaism is stronger than that. Judaism is better than that. We don't need to live with the questions. I've never seen this passage in the Maharal before until Rabbi Slifkin quoted it, and I love it. It's so resonant with me. Judaism is strong enough to stand up to our questions. Now, it might be true that at the end of the day, some questions are so good that you can't find answers, right? There's an example in the Gemara like this. The example of the Gemara is Moshe Rabbeinu asks Hashem, why do bad things happen to good people? This is like the question of Jewish philosophy, and there are lots of answers, and no one could agree on an answer, but we can mostly agree that we don't like the answers. There aren't that many good answers. And Hashem says, I can't actually answer that question for you. It's like too difficult for us to understand. So there's a place for you don't die from a question. But that place isn't before you start thinking of answers. It's after you start thinking of answers, and you might not find something that's so solid, but you have reason to be committed Jewishly anyway, you know, despite having a question. So, okay, put the question to the side, you come back to it a little bit later, new perspective, depth of knowledge, maybe it'll be a little bit easier to answer, but it's a last resort kind of approach, according to the Maharal and people like him. That's option one. You don't die from a question, but we don't love that option because we want to try finding the answers and learning from them. So let's take another approach. Second approach is a little bit technical, but I'm glad it was pointed out because it's a helpful example. Could be that we're just getting lost in translation here. Sometimes some of the references to mythical creatures might just be incorrect. No, the Rashi didn't actually say that, and the translation that we have of the old French word, you know, grouse, whatever, is not actually werewolf, it's something else. So that example doesn't really work, but there are examples like that. So for example, this is Pasuk in Yeshayahu. Al tismichi palashet, kulech, don't rejoice, palashet, Philistia, you know, the area of the Plishtim, ki nishbar shevet makach, the rod that smote you is broken. Don't rejoice. It's not a good reason to rejoice. Ki mishoresh nachash yetzei tsefa. From the root of the nachash, the tsefa comes out. Ufir yo saraf me'ofeth. And its fruit is a saraf me'ofeth, a flying saraf. Okay, so I left terms like nachash, tsefa, and saraf untranslated. And depending on how you translate them, you're going to end up with a mythical or non-mythical answer. So if you look at the what I marked here, the first translation on the page, this is from the Jewish Publication Society. So they have a number of translations. They had a translation that came out in 1917, then another one in 1983, I want to say, in 1986. Someone could check me on that. And they're both good translations, though they're different. And then another one came out in 2023. They're all available on Sepharia, if anyone uses Sepharia for their Jewish learning. So you'll see them there, along with other translations. So the JPS 1917 translates the tsefa as a basilisk. And I gave you a picture of what the medieval world thought a basilisk was. That is not a thing that looks real. So if you think, and there's the Harry Potter version of Basilisk, which is a different kind of creature, but also a thing that we probably don't think is real. So according to that translation, we might be dealing with a mythical creature, but if you look at other translations, viper or asp, which are both just kinds of snakes, so those translations don't involve the creation or the belief in a supernatural being. This is a very boring answer. It's a good one to know about, because you don't want to be sort of lured in by bad translations, misinterpretations of different sources. And so sometimes something that feels like it's outside the realm of possibility isn't really. It's really just you're using a bad English translation and don't rely on it. You know, check another translation before you start jumping to conclusions. Which won't solve our werewolf problem, because we have three sources, none of them seem ambiguous, there's no translation going on in any of them. But in theory, that's an option to have you to be aware of. It's a good option, but it's really a back burner kind of thing that's really only relevant when you're learning things in translation or interpretation. Sorry, yes?
Why would they change the translation? Like if the James Best had one in the early 1900s and then they did it again, like what makes them change it? Like the word specifically.
So it's a good question. The full answer would be look at their introduction to their new translation and they'll explain their methodology. Oftentimes, there are a couple of things that would change with like generations of translation. Number one would be style. Like, look at the first one and the third one. Rejoice not, O Philistia. Rejoice not, all Philistia. Right? It's just like a tighter, sort of more idiomatic English that's like more readable to the modern person. Whereas maybe 100 years ago, that earlier translation would have been a little bit more appropriate for biblical style. Sometimes there's new research in linguistics or in archaeology that gives you new information about the meaning of words. And sometimes there's updating words from older translations. So lots of English translations borrow from earlier English translations. And it could be that in Old English, Basilisk, and Rabbi Slifkin makes this point in his introduction as well, maybe in Old English, Basilisk might have just been another synonym for serpent. But now, in particular, it has a very mythological kind of meaning, so it's more misleading to keep that word. So it might be worth changing that word. But there are other features that go into their translation philosophy. And I read a book recently by Robert Alter. Robert Alter is not a Jewish scholar, but he's a scholar of Judaism. He has a very popular translation of Tanakh. And he has a book about biblical translation. And he explains like some of the features that go on and why he chooses to translate in this way and not that way. So if you care a lot more about translation, it's a good book to recommend. Okay, so that's approach number two. Both of them exist, and they work in their place, but they're not so comprehensive or satisfying. Option three is it's all a metaphor. I think we've talked about this before, right? The best manifestation of this is in the Rambam. The Rambam, in one of his introductions, in his commentary on the Mishnah, says there are three groups of people when it comes to understanding the stories and the agadot of the sages, and the Gemara and the Midrash. One group takes them all literally and believes them, and says, Chazal are so great, and they tell us these strange, incredulous, impossible things, and must be they're true, and how wonderful Jewish tradition is. And the Rambam says, that's wrong. Second group says, takes everything literally, and makes fun of Chazal. Chazal believe they're werewolves, they must be idiots. And the Rambam says, that's also the wrong approach. And he takes his third approach, which he takes, and his son takes, and generally is a very popular approach in Midrash, and in this sort of area, is to say you're not meant to read these things literally. You're getting bogged down in literalities when it says this supernatural thing happened. It's obviously not meant to be literal. It's obviously meant to be more metaphorical, more about teaching you a certain kind of value or lesson, and less about the particulars of, the literal thing that they're describing. And so Slifkin gives you an example of this phenomenon. It's in a string of examples in the Gemara and Bava Batra. So I'm just quoting one that he gives an interpretation for. Amar Rabba Bar Bar Chana. Rabba Bar Bar Chana said, "Lididi chazili, I once saw, hahi akrukta. I saw this frog, an akrukta, it croaks." I don't know if that's etymology, but I can't help thinking that's what's going on here. "Dehaveki akra, dehagrunya." You know, it's written in English. I barely understand these Aramaic words, so definitely should do it this way, it's easier. "I've seen a certain frog that was as large as these forts in Hagronia." And how large is the fort of Hagronia? It's as large as 60 houses. So it's a frog as big as 60 houses. Oh, but that's not it. "A snake came and swallowed the frog." Must be an even bigger snake. I mean, snakes can do big things, but still. "And a raven came and swallowed the snake. And then it flew up and sat in a tree." So there's a raven big enough to eat the snake that ate the frog, and then a tree big enough to hold the raven. Come and see how great is the strength of the tree which could bear the weight of that raven.
And then the father
thought, the ghost refuses. It has such Chad Gadya vibes. I was overwhelmed when I saw it. Exactly, right? Now, do you read Chad Gadya and think like, oh, that's a literal description of like a funny day that this man had and how much he bought this? No, of course not. It's obviously a song. But, so, and the sugya goes on, the Gemara concludes, and this is a great, I couldn't imagine a better conclusion. Rav Papa Bar Shmuel said, if I had not been there and seen this, I would not believe it. Yeah, it's not so believable. This is a crazy story.
It depends what type of shrooms you're taking.
Right, so he says he saw it. So what does it mean he saw it? That's a tricky term to translate, as you're noting. So some commentaries take this literally. Rashbam takes it literally. And he explains the reason of reporting all of the events is to talk about how great God's creations are, or to tell us how great the reward for the righteous are, or depending on the story, and there's a long series of stories in this Gemara, is going to come for some purpose, including to speak of the great birds, beasts, and fish, because all this conversation of Talmidei Chachamim requires study. So don't say this is just a nonsense anecdote or an Aesop's fable. Obviously, Chazal are serious people, and the things they say are serious, and so here it's clearly meant to explain some true phenomenon. That seems to be Rashbam's take.
I was just thinking, it's a good point that some people see all kinds of different things when they're hallucinating, but also, like, when we're dreaming, we also see lots of crazy stuff. I'm thinking maybe this person saw this in a dream. So it could be he actually saw this, and it was a dream. So.
Except two people saw it. Rabbi Bar Chana saw it, and then Rav Papa Bar Shmuel said, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't believe it. But obviously, he did see it. So,
How do we know that part? How do we know that this guy saw it? He's just saying, if I hadn't been there, I wouldn't have seen it. Wouldn't have believed it.
I don't know. Do you ever say, if I hadn't been there, I wouldn't believe it? If you actually weren't there? I think the phrase, if I hadn't been there, means, but I obviously was there.
Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it.
Right, exactly. So I think that's just like the best translation of the term, like the idiom that he's using, Ilo Havai Hatam, if I hadn't been there.
That was not how I understood it. I just thought he was saying that, I'll believe it. It's like a different way of saying I'll believe it when I see it, I thought.
Yeah.
It's just like a negative-negative, like it's like a contrapositive of like the same.
Right, but it's not like, if I were not there, like if I had not been there. It sounds to me a lot like he actually is describing having been there.
Yeah.
I'm not going to like say that's dispositive,
but
that's my implication.
But it's not directly stated.
Yeah, correct. He doesn't say, I was there and I also saw the same thing. You're right.
Yeah.
Right, so one possibility is he's describing a real thing that he...
Can I have one more elaboration?
Oh, yes, please. See if I have extras.
Yeah.
No, I have extras. Don't worry.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I've got
Let's give it to Harry.
Let's make sure I'm all set. Okay. Okay, so we could take it literally, and that would be an easy answer. There's no problem, after all, if you just believe the sages when they say that they saw these things and these things exist, right? Then there's no question. But if you're inclined to be skeptical about the existence of giant frogs, which some of us are, so you could read it metaphorically. And Rabbi Slifkin quotes from the Vilna Gaon an approach exactly like that. The perpetually croaking frog represents the perpetually studying scholar. It is the size of 60 houses, which represent the 60 tractates of Mishnah. Right? Every detail in this metaphorical reading is going to be symbolic and representative of some idea. Right? It's not a literal frog, it's a metaphor. I saw scholars studying. I saw great scholars who knew a great amount of information. They are described as being encompassed in a single city, rather than being 60 separate entities. This alludes to the fear of heaven that must encompass all of a scholar's learning. The snake that swallows the frog represents the trials of financial hardship that threaten to consume the Torah scholar. The raven represents the trust in God to provide sustenance, thus overcoming the serpent. And God grants help to the scholar in the form of a financial supporter, symbolized by the tree on which the raven sits. And so the whole point of this this metaphor, this allegory, was not to talk about supernatural creatures, but to talk about scholars overcoming financial hardship and succeeding in their scholarship. Rabbi Bar Chana commented on the tremendous accomplishment of this supporter, this tree who supported the scholar with his trust in God to be a scholar. Rabbi Papa Bar Shmuel, who came from Babylon, where the wealthy were less helpful, commented that he would not have believed how helpful were the wealthy people of Israel had he not seen it with his own eyes. So it's also a little bit of a, polemic or musr to the less than supportive communities. great to be talking about this right after our community cause match, which is far from very successful. A lot of great support for the Torah in our community, and this Gemara is apparently exactly about that. Fantastic. Right, great metaphorical reading of a difficult Gemara. So is that going to work to explain werewolves? Is that going to be a solution for us?
To figure out what the allegorical explanation for
werewolves. So first of all, right, the strength of saying this is a metaphor depends on having a good interpretation of that metaphor. Just saying, oh, it's a metaphor, that's not an answer. That's like brushing you off. What's it a metaphor for? What's it actually telling you? So that's a good point. I think there's a deeper reason why you might be hesitant to accept it in this case.
Because if you accept that it's a metaphor, that means you're accepting that there were no werewolves.
Right. And what is the impression you get from reading the sources?
Of course there were.
Exactly. The sources do not speak, they don't tell you stories about werewolves. They presume the existence of werewolves and then interpret things based on that. Right? What would it mean to say, oh, everything Rabbeinu Ephraim said about Benjamin being a werewolf was all a metaphor. Like, he's using it to explain events in Chumash. So are the events in Chumash also metaphors? Rachel didn't really die? It's very difficult to say in some of those examples. Rashi's not even giving you a metaphor. He's just translating a word. Chayat HaZadeh means werewolf. Oh, but it's a metaphor. Like, what's it a metaphor for? I don't even know how it could be a metaphor, let alone like what the actual metaphor is. So I think that's the deeper problem, right? Sometimes reading a midrash and saying it's metaphorical is great, and that's the Rambam's approach, and his son, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam's approach, and lots of Jewish traditions about reading these stories metaphorically, and we talked about this when we talked about the Leviathan, and there are plenty of ways we could do this in other sources. But it's not going to work here, because here these sources are just telling you facts about werewolves. Not metaphors, not allegories, not stories, just facts. We know that werewolves have the eyes of humans. Okay. So I think this isn't going to do us a lot of work here. A good tool in your toolkit, save it for later, but not going to help us right now, I think.
But can't it be said that in similar to us nowadays, like, we talk about things that aren't real as if they're real, or just as a metaphor, like the way we talk about creatures from fantasy books or movies or whatever, because that's the closest thing we can use to describe things like a giant beast or whatever. We'll say, oh, it was like a werewolf. Maybe these people had like stories that were passed down through the years that were never written down, but everyone knew about them. Like, everyone knew, oh, there's a story about a werewolf. So couldn't they just use that when they're talking about other things?
It had to come from somewhere.
So
they must have visualized something. They must have visualized something.
But you wouldn't reference a story about a werewolf unless it was something to do with a werewolf.
So it could be, this is an interesting point, right? So first of all, right, in order to have that tradition passed down, so someone would have to believe in it, but it could be that it's sort of like a cultural metaphor, right? I'm trying to think of like what a modern analog would be to that phenomenon. Bigfoot, right? So I could say that such and such was elusive, and I might say it was like Bigfoot. But I'm not saying that Bigfoot is real, and there is a thing that is like Bigfoot that also has the same properties of being elusive. I'm using Bigfoot as a metaphor, but Bigfoot doesn't actually exist. So that's an interesting possibility, and it might work for some sources. I'm not sure it's going to work for all of them, even if we just look at the ones that we have in the beginning of our sources. So, Rabbeinu Ephraim in source number 3. People who turn into wolves were created during the 6 days of creation. You know, Rashi in source number 7 says, and I love that he uses this word because it really like gets at the heart of the matter. He says, Chayat HaSadeh, the second line, the beasts of the field, Hushanikra grouse, or again, however we're going to pronounce that word, Belaz, in the foreign language, which is French, Vizohi Chayat HaSadeh Mamish. This is actually the beast of the field. Like, not, this is kind of like a beast of a field, a metaphor. This is the beast of the field, Mamish, in reality. So, it's a good, that's like a good adjunct interpretation. You know, when he says it, it's not, it's idiomatic more than it is metaphorical, right? So it's not a metaphor in that there's symbolism, but it's an idiom, you know, it's Bigfoot-like in that it is elusive, but not that it is necessarily real. Though I'm also not going to weigh in right now on whether Bigfoot is real. I'll leave that to everyone's imaginations.
About the werewolves. I wonder how they even came up with this.
So it's a good question. there's, if you want to do the literature on this, this is an interesting question. I can send you a few links. Historians will try to trace this idea, right? Historians, or Jewish historians, will try to explain, so where did the idea of werewolves first come from? And then, at what point did it trickle into Jewish sources, right? So it could be that it originated with us, and then it trickled out into general society. More likely, I think, is that it originated somewhere in secular society, or at that time, Christian society, and then trickled into Judaism, right? Like, the reason we believe in, I don't know, moose, is because other people believe in moose, and then they told us about moose, and then we believe them. I don't know if I've ever seen a moose, but I believe they exist, because I've seen pictures, and people have told me they exist. So I assume that's the direction it came, you know? Someone else figured out that this thing called werewolf existed, and they told us about it. But there are historians who will do the work of figuring out, like, where the myth of the werewolf comes from. And maybe it comes from certain medical conditions that make people look a little bit werewolfy. But
I was thinking, yeah, it could have been a werewolf syndrome.
Is there such a thing?
No. Well, people grow hair all over their body.
So it could be that there are, like, things like this that might be relevant. I can send a few links if we want to afterwards. You can dig into the history a little bit more than I did. Yes, sorry, thank you. Please.
First, Miss, I don't know if you said about it, if it trickled into us. Most of the time when it comes to certain things, it trickles from us into general society, because most things they take, from what I've seen, at least, they take from Judaism. So, like, different stories, they take it from a Jewish story. That's at least a lot of things I've heard.
Yeah. I think some and some, right? So, like,
right.
The idea that there's, like, a single God who expects us all to be moral and not a pantheon of gods that you're meant to bribe with food. Like, that was a great idea that we had. We're so cool and hip. And, like, thinking of that. No, but really, I mean that. Like, that's a great idea that we had. Mm-hmm. But, like, the theory, I don't know, like, Newtonian physics. Like, Newton thought of that and then told the Jews about it. And then Jews started doing some of it. But it's not like we thought of Newtonian physics a few hundred years before and, like, hinted it to Newton by throwing an apple at him and then hoping he'd figure it out. Right, so there's definitely a boat. Right, exactly. Hashem runs the apples. So there's definitely like a two-directional, you know, process there. I assume specifically in science, because it's not like Jews were like massive scientists. I mean, there were some, but I imagine a lot of...
Mathematics and science.
Medicine, you had a lot of. And some did mathematics. That's true. Right, maybe there's more room for that. That's true.
And my other question, yeah, please. Just some devil's advocate here about, like, for werewolves. Let's say they did exist at one point, and they're not around now, because it's like, because if you get into, like, Kabbalah or very spiritual things, it gets so complex, and it's like, I don't know what's going on. So maybe at some point it did exist. They did exist. And now, they're not around.
Answer number four. Answer number four is they used to exist, they don't exist anymore. Right? So I'm not going to, in the interest of time, I'm not going to summarize the literature here, but suffice it to say that there's this line in Tosfot in source number 16. You can look at the background if you want to see a little bit more, where Tosfot is bothered. The Gemara says that a cow can only give birth at 3 years old, but we see a lot of cows, and we know that cows can give birth at younger than 3 years old. So Tosfot says it must be that nature changed. Used to be cows could not give birth until 3 years old, and now they can. And this is an interesting idea in general. Like, sometimes there's reason to think this, right? We know, for example, that the average human being now is taller than they used to be. In that way, nature has changed because of better nutrition, right? We know that we are generally healthier and live longer and have fewer diseases than people used to. That's a way that nature has changed. So there are some areas where it becomes very plausible to say nature has changed. Now, I'm not a zoologist, so I'm not here to tell you why werewolves are categorically different than those changes. But I would guess the argument would go along the lines of, werewolves are not like a detail that we could accept what we know about science and biology, like generally, and it's like adjust the details when we like discover a new creature. So we have to, you know, adjust some of the details in our hierarchies or in our, you know, animal family trees. To believe in the existence of werewolves would be to believe something that is so paradigm breaking of science that completely, like, undermines any understanding we have of how creatures actually work, that is, like, beyond the pale of possibility within science. Now, why is it beyond the pale of possibility in science? We'll talk to a biologist. They'll tell you why that's beyond even, you know, what could be. But it is an approach that could exist to explain some details, right? Especially, you know, details within the physiology of certain creatures where, again, we're healthier, we're taller. Some details definitely could be changed depending on the era. But I don't think werewolves is going to be one of them. Again, maybe biologists will tell me I'm wrong. And in theory, science should be open to discovering evidence that werewolves actually do exist. In theory, like, always be open to observations. And if a reliable person tells you what's happening and you see photographic evidence, so maybe you change science and adjust. But until that happens, there's reason to be skeptical. Yeah.
Aren't there plenty of places, though, in the Torah where we kind of, you know, are expected to believe something that happened? Like, for example, when the Red Sea parted, that also is not science.
Different between no.
So there...
miracle.
Exactly, right? When God intervenes and changes the laws of nature and does a miracle, like, that's an exception to the rule. Okay. That just has to be, categorically, right? And in fact, that's what makes a miracle so great.
Okay.
That there's a rule called... the Red Sea's not going to split on its own, and then God comes and makes an exception. But I think it would be a pretty big icker. Like, I believe that God could make a werewolf exist in this room right now. Like, that's the thing I believe is within God's power. I don't think God would do so. I don't expect it to happen. I would not bet on it. But I agree that it's, like, possible. If we're going to believe that science is, you know, could tell us anything, you know, categorically doesn't exist or couldn't exist, so we're assuming in a non-miraculous context. Right? So yeah, like, it's true. It could be that there used to be werewolves and we just have lost them. Then you also have to explain, like, why God would make werewolves exist in the Middle Ages and then make them stop existing now. They could have continued to exist. Maybe they'd be really cool, but dangerous.
The first time invention was in the Epic of Gilgamesh and...
werewolves?
Yeah.
Huh.
And in Roman times and Greek.
Well, Roman and Greek times are at least 1,000 years after Gilgamesh, probably more. A few thousand years after Gilgamesh.
Yeah.
So Gilgamesh is definitely first. So it's a very old myth, is what we're saying.
Yeah,
it's a very old idea that we have. And in that sense, of course, like, if everyone believed it, so it's not necessarily so surprising. But we'll get there in a second. So we're at 9 o'clock, so I want to just kind of bang out 2 more ideas. I would love to have a little more time to flesh them out, but I want to be mindful of everyone's time. Option 5 is to say, everything we think we know about science is wrong, and we're supposed to trust Chazal. Trust the sages. They say there were werewolves, there were werewolves. Our science is good, but no one said our science is perfect. We definitely thought science was finished when Newton thought of mechanics. Surprise, there's a thing called quantum physics. So now we have to change all the rules again. You know, and I am very confident that there's going to be another, at some point in the future, another new way of thinking about everything we think we know about physics and everything we think we know about science. It's just going to be different than what we think it is. So to make any definitive statement based on what we think science says, that's foolish and short-sighted. We know that we don't know everything, and so we should defer. Chazal were really smart, plus they may have had a Masorah, so we should trust them. And the Chida in source number 18, in this sefer called Shem Gedolim, he, you know, is going through like a long itemized list of every sefer that he knows of, which is a crazy task. I love that he had the ambition to do this. So he goes through all the Sfarim, and in the context of talking about one sefer by the Ravid, he talks about how the Ravid was really a saintly person who had access to the divine. And he said, you know, nowadays there are some people who think they're so smart, they know science, they know better than Chazal. They forget that Chazal had access to divine inspiration. So when Chazal said they're werewolves, it's because they're really werewolves. And they think they know so much science, they don't know anything. It's an interesting disposition, interesting model. It's one that's very reverent. A lot of trust in Chazal, a lot of trust in our sages, in our tradition, and a lot of humility. I don't know that much. I think I know science. I don't really know science. I couldn't tell you why werewolves can't exist. I don't know anything about biology. So I studied bio on the high school level. Like, really, you know, I really don't know anything. I didn't even take it in college. So, like, why should I feel so confident in my knowledge? Even the best scientists admit we don't know so much. And so we should trust Chazal. And that's totally, totally an option. And there's a school of Jewish thought that thinks this. Trust Chazal. They're right. What we think we know about science is probably wrong. The weakness here, right, and this has been a trend, right, kind of seeing how each of these approaches has some limitations. So here, I think the biggest limitation on this approach is this assumption that Chazal had access to knowledge about science that we don't. Like, I appreciate if we say that Chazal have Ruach HaKodesh about halacha, about Jewish law, about how to interpret Chumash, about religious matters. To say that Chazal is supernatural scientific information, it could be. I'm not denying it.
I mean,
and the Chida thought it, and many others thought it. But I'm not sure why you would have to say so. And I think there's precedent for not saying so, and I'm going to show you that, and that's going to be approach number 6 and final, because we are definitely a little bit over time. approach number six and final is to say, not that our science is wrong and Chazal are right, but the reverse. Our science is right and Chazal are wrong. Now, not Chazal are wrong and dumb and stupid and they have nothing to say to us that matters, but Chazal did the best they could with the science that they had. When a rabbi gets up and gives a drasha based on the idea of quantum mechanics, which the rabbi, if he knows a lot about, could definitely do, that's assuming that quantum mechanics is the best way we currently know to understand the world. It might be, but it might be wrong. We might find out in 50 years that quantum mechanics is flawed. Great. So then the rabbis are going to give drashas with other scientific paradigms in mind. So when Rashi said werewolves, he was using the best science he had, which assumed there was werewolves. And when we say there are no werewolves, we're using the best science we have, which says that there aren't. And there's a great example of this in the Gemara. The Rambam says it in source 19, but the Gemara makes it even clearer. The Gemara says that the Jewish sages said, here's how the sun works. It crosses the horizon, it rises in the east, sets and goes to the west, and then sinks kind of behind the sky, so to speak, goes back around up top, and pops out the sky again on the east in the morning. And it keeps doing that every day. But the Gentile sages in the Gemara there say, no, it's not that, that's not how the sky works. Rather, it goes up over the earth, and then it goes under the earth. But up, over, and under again. Now, that's closer to what we have. Now, they didn't, the way they thought about it was not the way we thought, think about it. Right? They thought the earth was, you know, a flat thing, and that someone under it and, like, heated up the hot springs that then, like, bubbled up to the surface, which is not, you know, the sun is clearly too far away for that to work. But at the very least, at the end of that Gemara, Rebbe says, or the Yudah HaNasi says, the statement of the sages of the nation of the world appears to be more accurate than our statement. In other words, Rebbe, the authority behind the Mishnah, which is the authoritative text of Torah Shabbat Pah, said, Chazal thought one thing about science, the Gentile scientists thought the other thing about science, and they were right. And he gives you a reason to think so. So the simple way to read this Gemara, which is, Slifkin has a long footnote, where he quotes, I don't know, 30 authorities who read the Gemara this way, is that this was a real debate about science, and Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi really deferred to the Gentile authorities. They, when you have the best science of the time, science is not subject to religious authority. Just because you're a Tana doesn't mean you know more about science than anyone else. You do the best you can with the best scientific information you have, and we do the best we can with the best scientific information we have, and so on and so forth. Now this does not, and this is a very important asterisk to this interpretation, does not entail a dismissive attitude towards Chazal. This is a very respectful attitude towards Chazal. They offered the best interpretations they could with the best science they had available to them and are representatives of Jewish tradition and are still authoritative and are still people to revere. But being wrong about something doesn't mean we don't revere you. That's one asterisk that needs to be added to this interpretation. Right? We don't have to dismiss Chazal and say they were fools to say that they didn't know the best science because science has been progressing. And the second idea, and this is the one that really is important to stick with, it undercuts a little bit of the piece as a whole, but it's worth seeing. So Rabbi Slifkin closes this part of his introduction with this great paragraph. One must also consider whether it is particularly important in the given context that the information is accurate. Chazal may make a mistake about a scientific fact. It might not matter. Depends on the context, but sometimes it might not matter. The Ramchal writes, you should further know that many fundamental secrets were alluded to by the sages by way of matters of science or nature. However, the point is not the information about science or nature, but rather the secret that they wanted to allude to with it. It's the idea they're communicating to you. Chazal are primarily our authorities in halacha, in Jewish values, in chumash, in Torah, not in science. And so what they say about those things matters a lot. So they might use the vehicle of giant frogs to tell you a lesson about Torah. They might use a lesson about werewolves to tell you an idea about Torah. But it's not about the werewolves. That's not what they care about. They're not scientists. They're teaching us values. They're religious guides. Thus, it does not make a difference to the truth of this illusion, whether the parable with which they clothed it is true or not. They could be wrong about werewolves, but if they're right about the idea that, for example, Binyamin, when he left his father, would die, which is what the psukim say, and he interpreted that phrase for Binyamin dying and Yaakov dying. That's a great way to read the Psukim. Let's understand what that means. Let's understand the impact that has on Yosef and the brothers and Yaakov and Binyamin. We don't need to assume the werewolf piece to assume all the values that are being articulated by Chazal. I think that approach has the advantage, the disadvantage of being a little bit dangerous, because it inclines us towards being less reverential to our religious authorities, and that could have negative consequences, especially for people of, you know, more dubious kinds of religious commitment. But has the advantage of being able to happily live in both worlds. We trust Chazal and respect them and revere them, and we could be scientists in the full sense of the term, and trust the modern science that we have and not kind of shut off that part of ourselves or not trust it when it seems to contradict our religious approaches. So we are over time. So I'm not going to do our customary recap, but I want to thank everyone for coming. Yishar kol chachem. Happy to schmooze if anyone else wants to. Marot is probably happening in the other room for anyone who hasn't gotten it yet as well. Have a great evening.
And the next year is...